Every team, every topic, everywhere. This is Believe.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to yet another version of Bill Roden on Sports and Beyond. I always got to say that, and beyond, because we kind of go a lot of different places. Here in Harlem, USA, high above the fray in Harlem, USA, here with my friend and co-host, the great Jamal Murphy.
Sounds good to hear that, but yeah, I'm here again.
Yes.
Back in the house.
Yeah, it literally is the house. An undisclosed location. So Mimi, you know, like...
Yeah, you can't say anything.
Yeah, we're going to blindfold you. We should have forgot to give you a blindfold so you'd know where you were. But really excited to welcome our guest today. Really, Jamal's talked a lot about you. I kind of knew about you, but I didn't know you were you. My guest is the great, the wonderful Mimi Valdez.
That's a nice compliment. The great, that's nice.
Everybody,
that's his thing, though.
Yeah, but everybody. Well,
not with everybody.
No. Everybody doesn't get the great now. That's a very special designation. Aww,
thank you. I appreciate the kind words.
Yes. So Mimi is the chief. I think a lot of people know you in your current role. You're the chief creative officer of I Am Other, which is the media creative collective and record label production company founded by Pharrell Williams.
Happy. Yes.
And so, you know, I want to talk to you about that because you have so many roles.
I wear many hats.
Lots of hats. So we want to get into some of those hats. But what we're going to get to a little later, what people don't know, but what's very exciting is that you are also a producer, a movie producer, director, writer. You are the co-producer of the 2015 movie Dope, which was a movie about the, you can correct me, but a movie about the it's not dope. It's dope as in, what? That's dope. About the 90s hip hop culture. You're the executive producer, and this is really great. You're the executive producer of a movie that's going to be released in January of 2017 called Hidden Figures, which is... the story is really exciting. It's a story. It's a story of these three
mathematicians, black women, African American women who worked at NASA in the 60s and really helped America win the space race.
Hmm. I really want to get into that because that's again, those are these untold.
Exactly.
Completely untold. I have no clue.
No one knew.
And you know, it's funny. I mean, not funny, but we had on a couple. Guest ago, we had a
Riley Draper.
Debbie Riley Draper, who is sort of your counterpart, but she did this story about the 1936 Olympics, but about the 17 black men that nobody really knew. Everybody knows the Jesse Owens story, she did this story about the 17 other black people on the team that nobody knew, including these two women who were the first two black women to make an Olympic team. And she told stories, and she discovered that story by telling the story of this black woman who was a trumpet player who was in a Nazi concentration camp.
Oh wow!
Yeah, I mean, but so when I heard yours, so it's just you've got all these untold stories.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. I mean, look, and we have to give thanks to Margot Shetterly who wrote the book that comes out in September. Proud and lucky to be a part of a story like that, a movie like that, to bring it to the big screen is very exciting.
It's very exciting. We're going to get into that a little later.
Okay.
But, you know, obviously everybody knows Pharrell. I mean, he was behind the scenes of a lot of great stuff before. Then he kind of blew up.
Yeah, 2013. Right? I remember that at the end of the year, people were calling 2013 the year of Pharrell because he started off with Get Lucky, then it went into Blurred Lines, and then it just exploded with Happy at the end of the year.
But when that exploded, you exploded, because then people start wondering, wait a minute,
The Happy video was actually my idea, in the sense that we were, you know, Pharrell had who were trying to figure out doing a video for it, and I hate even saying it was my idea, because I felt like the idea was in front of our face. I simply was like, oh, you should do what Gru does in the movie when Happy plays, which basically the lead character, he realizes he's falling in love and he's happy and he starts dancing down the street. So I was like, oh, you should just do that. That was it. So I kind of don't even feel right taking credit for the idea.
Take the credit.
Like, take credit, please.
Because it was right there. Yeah. But then I also have to then, again, give credit to our amazing directors. We are from LA. They were the ones that then kind of built on the concept and came up with the whole 24-hour idea and, of course, was brilliant. And, again, an amazing, amazing experience to be a part of because it was really emotional, I think, for all of us to see something that we had worked on have that kind of effect. I mean, we felt like we had a really great idea, and when we were doing it, we're like, oh, this feels like it could be big, but nobody could have predicted what actually happened.
Tell me about that. I mean, you know, I'll jump a little out of order, but I know, you know, here at our, we run a little sports and recreation program here, kids 7 to 14, and we bring in a lot of different people. As a matter of fact, I'm going to hit you up after this to come and talk. But the thing is, to young people, you know, we talk a lot about dreams.
Yes.
And a lot of times you never, if somebody would have asked you when you were like 10, 11 years old about this huge thing, you probably would have said, I don't know what you would have said.
Yeah,
you know?
I think I would have thought they were crazy, to be honest, right? Because I'm born and raised in the projects, Chelsea projects downtown, you know, not a lot of money, you know, just being, you know, Latina and Afro-Latina, Black Latina, like these are things I'm not supposed to succeed based on where I came from and sort of my background. So yeah, if you would have told me that at 10, I would have just sort of been like, what?
But you felt that? You feel like you felt that at 10 that you weren't supposed to succeed?
Well, it's not that I didn't let me phrase it, because my mom was very much about education and my grandmother. Like, that's all that I heard in my house was like education, education, because their whole thing was like, get us out of here. Like, please, you know, you're smart. Like, get us out of here. Be a doctor, be a lawyer. You know, like that's all I heard from my mom. Doctor, lawyer, doctor, because that's all she knew in terms of success. So that was what she was pushing for. So it's not that I didn't think that I couldn't succeed. I just felt like the world didn't expect me to succeed based on sort of who I was, my background and whatever. So I just felt like I had a lot of challenges, and I just knew that I had to work harder than everyone else. I had to, you know, study, I had to, you know, concentrate, that it wasn't just going to be, I didn't have a rich relative who just was going to hook me up with an opportunity, you know, like I knew that, you know, wasn't my reality. So it was more about just so knowing that I had the odds stacked against me and feeling kind of excited and confident about, you know, what it was that I wanted to do. Because at that time, 10, what did I don't think I had figured out what I wanted to do yet. Actually, you know what? Maybe lawyer, because I was in my head because of mom. So that was probably like, oh, yeah, maybe I'll be a lawyer, whatever. Mm-hmm. But then it wasn't until teen years, I was always great in English, and I loved writing and, you know, reading, and, you know, sort of those were always my best subjects. And I was fascinated with magazines since I think I was 3 years old. I used to take my mom's magazines, cut them up, do all. So I was, but it never dawned on me that it could be a career. And it was a next door neighbor of mine, you know, sometime in, you know, maybe high school, 14 or 15, that she simply was like, you'd be good at that. You should, you know, you could get a job in that. And I was like, huh? Like, it just clicked, you know? Like, I was like, and that's another thing that I think is really important, that as human beings, we have to encourage the youth, because it was that simple statement of just someone saying you can do that made me go, oh, okay, maybe I, you know, I need to consider that. Meanwhile, my mom was like, what?
Go to law school.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing. I had the same thing about journalism and being a sports writer. I said, you know, I it must have been really late, like 18 or something, that what, you get paid for doing this? You know, but the whole idea is you just have no idea, particularly a lot of our kids. You just have no idea.
You don't know of all the possibilities.
All the possibilities.
You sure don't.
So take us back. I mean, I wasn't going to do a, so like a month by month of your career, but you let's kind of how you might do this in a movie where you're standing next to whatever the high point. Tell me what the high point of you when you're saying you never could have believed. Let's say the high point, 2013, is it?
2013, the year of Pharrell, yes.
The year of Pharrell. Mm-hmm. And there must have been a moment when it was just, it almost reached its
Well, here's what happened. Because of that success, a lot of opportunities started coming our way. And he's with William Morris, the agency, and Pharrell had always wanted to get into movies, but hadn't kind of figured it out yet. Mm-hmm. And so once all the success happened, you know, everyone on the team, I think we all naturally like, okay, how can we use this success right, to parlay right. the next situation? Like, what can we do? And so they, you know, our agents at William Morris knew that we had wanted to get into movies. So this project came by, dope, Pass was introduced to us, and it was simply like, oh, we have a writer-director. He has an idea. He didn't have a script, nothing. It was just an idea. Will you meet with him? So when we met with him, he didn't say this, but I remember coming away from the meeting being like, oh, okay, nerds in the hood, navigating all the drama and, you know, figuring it all out. And I was like, oh, I could relate to that because that's how I grew up. That's how Pharrell grew up. So it was, I think at that moment, so that's, I guess, 2014, that I realized that, oh, wait a minute, this could be a really great opportunity for me because I had these journalism roots. For those first 2 years, two years, I guess, working with Pharrell, we were so dedicated on sort of him and sort of getting his whole career back together that while I was doing a lot of cool creative stuff, I wasn't necessarily telling stories, which is, again, what I love, which is why I loved magazines, why I loved journalism, why I majored in journalism at NYU. So I think it was at that moment of working on Dope that I was like, oh, I need to do this. This is what I need. This is the next thing for me.
Mm. So let's go back to that high moment. Now we go back when you're 10 and you're growing up in the projects and you're this Latina woman, this Afro-Latina woman. What are the major steps that led you to stand next to Pharrell at that moment, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17? When you look back on it, what are sort of the key moments that kind of led you to that moment?
A couple things. Because I was naive, once my neighbor put that in my head that I could work in magazines, and then I researched that the magazine industry was basically here in New York City. So in my head, I was like, well, of course I'm going to get a job at a magazine, right? People come from all over the world to come, you know, get a job at magazines. I live here. Like in my naive mind, I felt like, oh, I can do that. So I had this sort of very tunnel vision of like, okay, I'm going to major in journalism and, you know, I'm going to get a magazine job. But I still had my, well, I'm going to try it. If it doesn't work out, I'll go to law school. Mm. That was my plan. Like, I was like, I'm going to try this magazine thing. Luckily, Quincy Jones was just starting Vibe magazine. I was lucky enough to get an editorial assistant job there. And that was an amazing experience because I was, again, even though I loved magazines, it never dawned on me. I just assumed I would work at a women's fashion magazine because it didn't really exist, right? Hip-hop magazines and urban music culture. And The Source came a little later. But it wasn't until Vibe that when I saw that first test issue and they just kind of put it out there to see if the marketplace would respond to it, I was like, oh my gosh, this is it. This is where I need to work. It combines everything, magazines, my love of hip hop. So Vibe was a very big turning point for me because not only that did I eventually become editor-in-chief, it's where I first met Pharrell. Like I interviewed him. Yeah, that's where we first met. And I interviewed him on the phone for an article and we really clicked and connected. I felt like he was very special and different than what I'm used to, you know, kind of, you know, you're in the industry and you meet so many people. And he was just so honest in that interview. I remember he was, this is when the Neptunes they were just starting to explode. And he was so, again, very honest about like, oh, everyone's calling us thinking like, we're the answer. We're not the answer. Like, we just want to make music. You know, that pressure of like, feeling like, oh, the Neptunes are going to deliver a number one pop hit. And I just was like, wow, I don't know if you should be saying this to a journalist, but I appreciated it because it was so honest. So then when I did the Justin Timberlake cover story for Vibe, the Neptunes did most of that album. I went down to Virginia and spent a lot of time. And that's when we sort of connected. And immediately, weirdly enough, because as a journalist, you're not supposed to do this, but we became really good friends, like a very kind of brother-sister relationship. But it worked because we both didn't expect anything from each other, right? Mm. Like, you know, he didn't expect anything from me because of my position. I didn't expect anything from him. As a matter of fact, lots of times I would hear stuff and couldn't repeat it because I'm like, this is not fair. Like I'm hearing in capacity as a friend. I can't then have my journalist hat on, like, oh, what's happening? So my rule would always be like, all right, I needed to hear it from at least two other sources before I would, you know, because so that was maybe a little tricky for me, but we made it work. And then, you know, we were friends. It's actually 15 years now that since then that we've been friends. And then when he decided to start I Am Mother, he asked, you know, if I would join on. And I had actually recommended another really good friend of mine to come work with him. And they were like, well, why don't you come on too? And at first I was like, all right, this is either going to be a nightmare working with like two of your best friends, or it's going to be awesome. And it's been awesome.
Really? I mean, that must have been a big step too, to find to jump out of the whole journalism thing.
Yeah, no.
And then get into
it was into the business. It was very scary because, you know, so after Vibe, I eventually went on to Latina. I was editor-in-chief there. And what I will say, I think the way Pharrell convinced me was because he was like, look, you love content. And, you know, eventually I want to do movies. I want to do TV. And here's an opportunity to do all types of content. And I think while that kind of scared me, it excited me at the same time. And I was like, you know what? You know, it's, you know, being at Latina, being at Vibe, I was editor in chief. So once
you were the boss,
I was the boss. Right. So it's like you get to those levels and, you know, eventually it's like, there's only so many places you can sort of go. And I just didn't know if I had, I wasn't sure if I had a real opportunity to go to other magazines. Cause if, you know, it's like, you know, what, I don't know. I guess I was unsure whether or not that was actually.
Where else would you go if you were going to stay in?
If I would have stayed in magazines, I mean, I think part of, I've always loved women's fashion. So that was always kind of an, you know, a possibility. But that opportunity didn't come, right? It didn't manifest itself. And then I think at the time I was working with BET right before when Pete said that he was going to start I Am Mother. And he just, again, I just looked at it as a challenge. Like, you know what? This could be actually really cool. I would love to do movies and TV. Like, let's figure it out. And so, you know, that was 2011. And the first 2 years we were really focused on him. Like, we were like, all right, what can we do? You know, he was in the studio working with artists and just trying to kind of build out the plan. And then really at the top of 2013 is when everything finally hit. And that's when, you know, first with Get Lucky by Daft Punk and then Blurred Lines, Robin Thicke. And then as someone I think I've read somewhere, they called it a victory lap. Happy was the victory lap for the end of the year.
A big time victory lap.
A huge victory lap.
You know, at the end of 2013, because that was November 21st. That was the day that we put the video up. I remember it distinctly in my head.
And weren't you in the video?
Yes, I'm in the video, but I'm in the 24-hour version video.
Okay.
I am.
But the movies and TV thing, you said it's always something you wanted to do, but is that something you had really thought about while you were editor?
No. Well, at Vibe as editor-in-chief, we did an award show, and I was executive producer, one of the executive producers on that. We did a news magazine show every week, a syndicated show. I was a co-executive producer on that. It had been in my head. A really good friend of mine, Cheo Hodari Coker, who another journalist turned screenwriter. He did the Notorious B.I.G. movie.
Okay.
Right.
And he's actually the showrunner, executive producer of the upcoming Luke Cage show on Marvel's Luke Cage on Netflix. He, from the 90s, he was like, Mimi, I think you'd be good in Hollywood. And I was like, yeah, really? And he was like, yeah, you'd be good. He was, because he always knew he wanted to be a screenwriter. But, you know, again, you just, unlike the magazine industry, which was in New York, and I was so naively confident, like, of course I'm going to get a job there. Hollywood always felt like a fantasy, far away, like, how do you even do that? Can you get into movies? So it was never a concrete thing that I was like, sort of like, oh, okay, how do I do it? But when the opportunity came across my desk, I pounced.
And you know, and I guess that's because I've been trying to get to this concept of if you're a 13, 14, 15-year-old person listening to this and you're kind of thinking, how am I going to succeed?
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned one thing. I remember a long time ago when I interviewed Julius Erving. This was a long time ago. We're kind of the same age, ancient now. But but I remember he said something about, you know, you have to dare to be great.
Yeah.
And when I thought about it then, you say, yeah, okay. But then as you get older, you realize that you have to dare to be great because it does take an act of courage, an act of self-confidence.
It does. I totally agree with that. And what I would add is that I think that it's really important to stay curious. I feel like curiosity has sort of led my ambition or driven my, you know, sort of career in so many ways, because I think, you know, when you're in kindergarten, everybody's curious. And then as we get adult, you know, get older and as adults, I think people kind of lose their sense of curiosity. I'm, as a journalist, just because I was trained as a journalist, and just I'm a person who just loves people and culture, and I'm always like, you know, I want to know more. And I think it's important to continue that as you get older, because that I think is what has led me to wear so many hats throughout my career. Because I'm like, oh, what's that? Oh, I want to see what that is. Oh, what's that? What's that? Okay, what's it? You know, like I've always sort of jumped around because I think that I'm just naturally curious. And I think if you feed your curiosity on a consistent basis and are always sort of looking for whatever that next thing is, or just, you know, I think a lot of times people think like, okay, well, you're in, I don't know, whatever field you're in, hip hop, and that's it. You have to know everything about hip hop. Sure, you should know everything about hip hop, but in order to be really successful in hip hop, you'll be more successful if you know a bunch of other things, like other kinds of music. Mm. I don't know, architecture, whatever it is. Like all these, everything
but
informs.
It all comes together.
It totally all comes together. It totally comes together. I mean, our best MCs are the most well read ones. Like Jay-Z is. You know, he reads books, and then that's obvious by his rhymes when you listen to him. So it's like, I just think it's important to whatever it is that you love and you want to do, that's great, but be well versed in the world. It's super helpful.
Our guest is the wonderful and beautiful.
Aw, thank you.
When we start doing our video podcast, I mean, people will also be able to see too. But for now, just take.
Take his word for it.
The wonderful Mimi Valdez. She's a creative officer of I Am Other, which is the media creative collection, collective and radio label production company of Pharrell Evans. What kind of Pharrell Evans? That's a guy, a friend of mine. Who works
for oh, yeah?
Sorry, Pharrell Williams. We like to have you on the show. But tell me, what you wear a ton of hats. You know, that's where you said joking before. Yeah. We do that. I'm like, you do a lot of stuff. What do you do? What are your different functions?
Yeah, it depends. I mean, now in sort of, you know, my title is Chief Creative Officer, and then also, you know, in Hollywood, I'm known as Pharrell's producing partner. And all that means is that, you know, I'm just out there always looking for projects, whether it's reading scripts, whether it's meeting with other producers to see what projects they have that could be interesting, whether it's reading an article and trying to figure out whether it can be turned into a story, whether it's meeting with network executives, seeing what's going on with, you know, whatever slate they have and seeing if we can be a part of it. Obviously, you know, movie studios as well. It really varies on day to day, but I'm a storyteller first and foremost, so I'm constantly always looking for stories that can be told in the visual medium. Now with my sort of new role with concentrating on film and TV.
How did you get to NYU? We kind of got to the 10-year-old girl who was kind of figuring out how to get up. But how did you get to NYU?
So NYU, from the time I was 9 years old, my mom kind of threatened me, said I had to get in because she had just gotten a job at NYU Medical Center.
Oh, wow.
And one of the benefits is if your child gets into school, free tuition.
Wow.
So that's all I heard from the time I was 9 years old. So I had to get in
did it.
Yeah, and I did it. But that's all I heard. I was threatened my whole life.
Okay, that's a lot of money. I mean, that's a big...
Listen, and it was funny because at first I was so wild. You know, I knew NYU was a great school. My mom was so strict with me, and I grew up with my mom and my grandmother, you know, all-girl Catholic school, St. Jean's High School over here on 75th between 3rd and Lexington. And
you went to a Catholic school.
Yeah,
you,
all girl Catholic
you're
school.
One of those.
Yep, I'm on one of those. Grammar school as well. So they were so strict with me, and I couldn't do anything. So part of me, I wanted to go away for college, and which of course they were like, my mom was like, you cannot go away to college, you know. And I was like, well, I might want to go away. And I was playing around with it. And then I was like, you know what? Here I have this opportunity. If I get into the school, it's free tuition. It's in New York. I don't even know my own city. If I go away to college and people are like, oh, yeah, have you ever been to wherever New York? I'm not going to know what they're talking about because I haven't experienced my city. So I was like, let me just stay here and, you know, let's just try to get into this college.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, we're going to take a break pretty in a minute. But what's the difference? I mean, I love L.A. There's no place like New York.
No, there's no place like New York.
There is no place like, I mean, I just told, you know. But It's interesting, though, to go, you know, I figure, well, in the ideal world, I mean, I love the West Coast.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
As soon as I
LA.
Land there, I'm like, yeah, because, you know, the L.A. still has that little craziness that you kind of need. What's the difference as you go back and forth?
I'll tell you what the difference is, especially now. Like, the first time I ever went to L.A. in the 1990s, I remember thinking, like, oh, okay, it's, you know, it's cool. It is what it is. It's a little, you know, very different from New York. Now I find, given that New York is not the New York I grew up in, right? It's just very, it's just a very different place, whether it's like super expensive rents or just, you know, all these, you know, my grandmother, when I was younger, used to say they're going to make Manhattan for the rich. And I was like,
absolutely.
What is she talking
that's
about?
That's what Bill says every day.
You know, so just that, you know, it's becoming harder and harder for creative people to live here, to make a living, for diversity to really thrive in the city. I mean, it still exists. But it's I don't know, you just feel the difference from when I was, you know, born
sounds
in 19...
Sounds like they have to rent poor people or something.
Well, no, you know, it's like, I think of, like, I was born in 1970, so I think of, like, you know, from then to now, like, it's just changed so much. Whereas, so now I feel like in L.A., because it's cheaper, because you have all-around great weather, a lot of New Yorkers are flocking to L.A. because it's, like, there's just so many opportunities out there, especially if you're trying to do entertainment, where the music business is basically moved to LA. Hollywood obviously has always been there. Tech business is out there. There's just more opportunity, and the weather is amazing.
Oh, paradise.
Weather is amazing.
You know, but you know, and it used to be, a friend of mine. We had Ron Carter on the show, the great bass player. But he was telling it used to be, and I'm, you know, I used to write about the music. I'm into jazz, that kind of stuff. And it used to be, when guys would go out to the West Coast, you know, New York guys would say, okay, don't spend too much time out there because, you know, you got to come back here and get the edge
right,
back.
Right, right, right.
But you're right, exactly right, because of the economics, because, you know, it's almost, I wouldn't want to go as far as saying the creative essence is leaving New
York.
Yeah,
I'm not
going to. You have to be very careful.
Yeah, I'm not. Yeah, I agree with you. Because the thing that LA will never have that New York has, like, you know, just getting on the train or walking down the street
right.
and seeing so many different types of people
right.
and that energy and those textures that you can't really
the,
find in
the
LA.
Closeness to people.
Yeah, just the closeness
and
to
the
people.
Intensity.
Just hearing right. conversations and seeing people and seeing how people are interacting. Like that.
And pace.
Just all of that. Yeah. I think, like, as much as I love LA, I always think it'll be a back and forth kind of thing for me because
right.
I need the New Yorkness
right.
of things. Like, you know, you just need
that. You
almost
that, have
to
plug in. You know, it's funny when you fly back into New York after you've been away for like about 2 weeks. I always feel after I've been on the West Coast, which I love, whether it's Northern, Southern,
mm-hmm.
even in, I consider Las Vegas even.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but after about a couple of weeks, you're like, okay, it's time to, I'm just kind of, okay, it's time to get back. Because, you know, you want to literally go out at any time at night and be surrounded by people. And it's so funny, when you fly, when you land back, you know, into Kennedy, it's funny, you just immediately feel the energy.
Yeah, you feel that. It's true.
You know, anyway, so listen, we're going to take a quick we're
okay.
going to take a quick break. We'll be back. We're going to talk about movies,
okay.
your movies, with Mimi Valdez, the wonderful Mimi Valdez. We'll be back in just a couple seconds on Bill Roden on Sports and Beyond. Harlem, USA, with Mimi Valdez and my friend and co-host, the great Jamal Murphy, hanging in from Brooklyn.
Deep, not too deep.
Not too deep, I know. I know. Is where you live, is that? That's gentrified, right?
Oh. That's been gentrified. Over there.
Been gentrified.
I mean, it's like South Slope, Park Slope area.
Oh, man. It's just the whole thing. I live in Park Slope, too.
Okay.
At the point where bought a little, it's another lifetime ago, but bought a little car right there on Grand Army Plaza.
Oh, okay.
And
yeah.
Every time I walk by, I mean, it just sold maybe 5 years, about for $500,000.
More than that, I'm sure.
Well, then, but every time I walk by the place, I almost break down.
Oh,
I cry.
Yeah.
But then I had to
yeah.
remind myself,
yeah.
and I go down this whole memory lane of if I knew then, but I said, and I had to remind myself, my brother, you are where you are.
Yeah.
And you know that kind of you false pep talk.
No. It's you will, you know, you'll just beat yourself up. You just got to let that go and be like, look, that's what it, that's what felt right at the time. I'm gonna stick by it.
It, didn't
it is
feel
what it
right
is
right at the time. I said, Bill, you fucking up. You knew you were fucking up then. However, but it's relational. Anyway, listen, at the beginning of the show, we were talking about these you're really now getting into being a producer, an executive producer. Mm-hmm. Tell us about you did Dope, which came out in 2015.
Yep, last year, last summer.
So just and now
on Netflix now.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. It's on Netflix now, yeah.
I'm in my little home office here. I've got the big screen. I've got Netflix. I wrote it down because I want to go.
Check it out.
But I'm very, I want to hear about that, but I'm really, really, really excited about Hidden Figures, which is coming in January. Tell us about that because that's really a big deal.
Yeah, no, that's really exciting. So that, again, talk about just, this was random how this even came about. So Donna Gelati, legendary Hollywood producer, Shakespeare in Love, The Reader, Silver Linings Playbook, all movies that got nominated for Best Picture. She actually won for Shakespeare in Love, one of, I believe, six female producers who have ever won the Oscar. And all those movies, the lead won for Best Actress as well. So she just, you know, she has a really good streak in Hollywood. So I had a meeting with her about another project, and then we just started talking. I was like, oh, what else are you working on? And then she starts telling me about Hidden Figures, NASA, mathematicians, African-American women, Virginia, and I might have fell off my chair. Like, I was so like, wait, what? I said, no, listen to me. I was like, Pharrell will do anything for us to be a part of this project. Wow. Please let us be a part of this project. And I think at first she was kind of taken aback, like, well, you know, because I think she had just sold it to Fox 2000. She already did the screenplay. You know, she had already identified a director. It was kind of, everything was already done. So I think she was looking at me like, well, what are you guys going to do? Right. Like, how, you know, it's kind of done. But I was like, look, let me put you on the phone with Pharrell. Mm. Next day, I put her on the phone. We have this conversation. Pharrell, you know, is from Virginia. You know, obsessed with NASA ever since he was a little boy. Wow. You know, totally, you know, all pro women. That's, you know, most of the people he has working for him are women. And so we just sort of made a case. We begged. That meeting happened when I met with her, was last July. We met with the studio in October, Elizabeth Gabler, head of Fox 2000. And again, just, you know, we made a case. We were like, look, let us be involved. For I was like, you know, I can do the music, I can do this. And he had already been working on 60s inspired music, but not really knowing what he was going to do with it. And I think at one point he was like, oh, maybe it's an album. As soon as this project came about, I was like, it's for this. this is where that music is for. So then we just kept talking to them, you know, read the script. Margot Shetterly, an amazing journalist who was in the process of writing the book. So we were doing the movie while she was still finishing the book, which was crazy. But it wasn't until, I guess, we started pre-production in January, but we were still kind of figuring out our deal. Like, it was still a big question mark. So it wasn't until March that the deal finally closed and we got on this project. But man, we were desperate because we were like, this is important and we need to be a part of this story.
And tell me, oh, by the way, I just want to let you know, you mentioned Shakespeare in Love. The bedroom was right there.
Really?
It was right there.
Oh my God, that's so crazy.
They put these doors here just to make it, but the bedroom was there and the whole thing. But Shakespeare in Love, that part was shot.
Oh,
right,
that's
here.
Crazy. Yeah. Wow.
So just
little movie trivia.
But tell us the story, because it's really, it's a phenomenal hidden story.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, 1960s, you know, this was a time where, you know, everyone was freaked out about Russia, and Russia, you know, was doing all the space exploration, and we had to kind of figure it out. And NASA had, well, I guess after the war, they had to hire women to, you know, do a lot of these calculations. And then I think they got desperate and they're like, all right, well, now we need to hire black people because we need more hands, you know, doing this sort of stuff, more brains. So that's how Katherine Johnson, Mary Jackson, and Dorothy Vaughan, you know, came to NASA and get these careers. And, you know, these were sort of, you know, middle class, highly educated women living in Virginia, and they participated in such a huge way a couple of missions, but specifically the movie focuses on John Glenn's mission, which was first human space orbit. And I mean, again, like he wouldn't, John Glenn, and you know, this, I don't know if I'm giving too much of the movie away, but I think this has been documented, but he, this was when the IBM computers first got to NASA, and they were still kind of testing them out and trying to figure it out. John Glenn didn't trust the IBM. So before the launch, he was like, I'm not going up. Have Catherine check the numbers. So she checked the numbers of this, like, he would not go into orbit without knowing she had, like, you know, he didn't trust the computer. Right. You know, I mean, like, that's a crazy story, and no one knew this. And this is what Margot, you know, Shetterly, you know, it's in her book, and uncovering this fact, and this woman is, I mean, and she's still alive. She's 98. Catherine Johnson is 98 years old. Actually, in this month's Vanity Fair, they have a beautiful portrait of her by Annie Leibovitz, and a story. You know, and she was honored with, and I'm always forgetting the name of the highest honor that the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
Medal of Freedom.
She was honored last year. Obama put that right around her neck. She was sitting there in her wheelchair. I mean, this is an extraordinary woman who is very confused by the hoopla, by the way. She does not understand. Like, she's like, oh, I just did my job, right? Like, she, you know, because to her, numbers were, that's it. You're either right or wrong. She did her work. It's not a big deal to her. But, you know, this movie with Taraji P. Henson and Octavia Spencer and Janelle Monáe playing the three lead characters. Kevin Costner is the head of the space program. He's awesome in it. And, again, just so amazing to be, you know, someone like him to be a part of a project. And I think everybody, cast and crew, we all knew how important the story was. So the energy on set was very like, we got to get this right. Like, this is an important part of history. This isn't just about making a good movie. This is telling these women's stories and hopefully in the process inspire a new generation to consider STEM careers, you know, science and math. Like, these things are really important. Like, we're all in entertainment, and sure, it's cool and fun, and I think we provide, you know, some service of just, you know, impacting and influencing in our little way, but the world cannot exist without math,
reading,
and science,
writing,
and
arithmetic.
Going to space.
You know, like, these are things that, like, you know, so if in that was a personal goal for Pharrell and myself, that we were like, man, if we could get, you know, young girls and just young people in general excited about, like, look what math can do. Look what science can do. Look what the kind of impact you can have on the world. Well, that was important to us.
Well, what impact? I mean, you mentioned at the very beginning you described yourself as a Latina, but also as an Afro-Latina. Mm-hmm. Are there enough images? And I know I'm thinking, you know, once Hillary, I hope, wins the presidency.
Yeah,
just because the alternative is just...
Yeah, let's just put it out there that Hillary's winning.
Because
we have
or
to.
Or else you talk about space. As Sunrise says, space will be the place. Yeah. If that's just...
I think we're all going to Saturn. Yeah, we're all going. Right.
Without the numbers.
Yeah, exactly. Just but I think that's why there's such a excitement, too, about this movie, because ultimately, yes, they were black women, but this movie is about females, right? Mm-hmm. Like, this is about, like, you know, this is a female story, and I think that that's really relevant right now in the sense that, you know, you have, you know, Hillary running, and I think we're all crossing our fingers that she wins in November, so we're going to go into this being in the air, and there are not enough inspiring female stories, and I think that's why this movie also has some global appeal, because it is about, you know, a strong female. First of all, we've never seen this level of brilliance in women, let alone black women, on the screen. It just hasn't happened. Like, this kind of, like, it's like non-existent, which is crazy.
Are there enough positive models also about Latina women? Because, you know, we're talking about hidden stories.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, they exist, but again, we haven't seen them on the big screen. And I think that's what, you know, Pharrell and our, you know, our goal with I Am Other and continuing to produce movies and TV is, like, you know, we obviously, you know, we're interested in all stories, but we're especially interested in the ones that haven't been told. And the ones that haven't been told are the ones mostly of people of color and just interesting, you know, just finding things that, cause to us, like, even though Dope, predominantly black faces, you know, Hidden Figures, I guess it's, you know, the leads obviously are all black, but there's, you know, a lot of white character supporting roles in there as well too. But even I think it's important that even when there are predominantly people of color as the dominant cast, what's important to us is that it has a universal theme, because if it has a universal theme, we believe it can appeal to anyone. You know, as people of color, we've been watching quote unquote white movies for years, but we've the ones that we relate to, the ones that it's a universal thing. It's like a universal theme that we all can relate to. That's what makes a successful movie. If you look back at like whether it's The Color Purple or Coming to America or, you know, whatever, like movies, those did really well. It wasn't just black people going to see those movies. Everybody went to see those movies because they appealed to everyone. The story was so good and it was that human, you know. So I think that's what we're trying to do is like, okay, yeah, so maybe these movies maybe have predominantly people of color, but anybody can relate to them.
And that's an interesting topic, because we talk about this a lot, and how popular really black culture is, and how, you know, you go to other countries, they know rap, they know jazz, they know the sports heroes, but in this country, it's, you know, we're kind of diminished, and you hear that a lot in the movies about the one of the reasons that there aren't as many colored people who are stars in the movies is because they don't think it'll translate overseas, or they don't think white people will come see them. And to me, that it doesn't really make intellectual sense when you look around and you see that it's, you know, black people have always been a draw in anything.
Right.
And so as far as the movie goes, in this, was there any pushback in terms of it being about three black women, or is there anything you had to offset that with? I know you have some, you know, Kevin Costner.
Yeah, no, because I think, I think internationally the response so far, I mean, we released a trailer. It seems really positive, but I think people are just focusing on like, gosh, this is a crazy historic moment that no one knew about, and these women affected it in a way. So I think I think it'll have international appeal, and that's so far what we're feeling. But yeah, traditionally it's been hard for movies that are predominantly African-American or black faces, people of color overseas, because that's usually been the thinking. But, you know, whether, you know, and again, we'd have to go movie by movie to be like, okay, yeah, no, that was never going to work. But I do think that the link is that it has to have a universal theme. If it does not have a universal theme for everyone to relate to, then it probably won't do well, you know?
And that's the case for a predominantly white movie as well.
True.
So it's really no difference.
Yeah. Mm.
You know, one of the things too, and we're going to take another break, but as I mentioned, we shoot at this place. There are a lot of movies that are shot here. And one of the things that continues to blow me away, even Shakespeare, is the whiteness of the crew. Not in front of the, but I mean, I'm like, you know, I mean, this, and I've been here for 20-something years, and there have been all these movies, Russell Crowe shot with, but invariably, all the crews, like, well, you may have like one brother in the middle of the street, you know, stopping the traffic, or one guy at night.
It's
protecting the parking space.
That's why it's important. Like, it kind of bothers me a little bit when people talk about like they only want to talk about on the producer level or the director level. And while those things are very important, you really have to, if you're going to have a real conversation about diversity in Hollywood, you got to look at everybody. You got to look above the line and below the line, right? So you have to look to see all the people that are involved, right? To before you start complaining, like, well, how come so and so? It's like, look at the whole picture, and because it is very important. It's not just, you know, Wynn Thomas, amazing production designer, African American man. He's actually been nominated a few times, I think, for an Oscar. He worked on Hidden Figures. I remember having a conversation about with him, and him, you know, just learning what he's been trying to do to bring more people of color into the production design field, and just letting people know, like, hey, this isn't, you know, you see that scene in a movie that it just wasn't there. They came in and dressed it, and they did all those things. But again, it goes back to what we were saying earlier. I don't think enough people in our community understand all the different types of jobs that are available. There's production design, there's cinematography, there's locations, there's wardrobe. There's so many opportunities, but we're not getting the word out. And I think that's what we're trying to do, you know, slowly but surely, at least what we're trying to do at I Am Other.
And that's what you, and I think that at a certain point of your life, if you're a person of color, if you're black, that is basically your role. You know, at a certain point of accomplishment, your role now is sort of running that third leg of the relay where you're handing off. For example, I'll tell companies when they come here, and sometimes I get in these debates, we run the sports program, I mean the recreation program here on Saturdays, and they're set up. I'm like, you know what? I would like you to take our kids, because we go to the Crypt Chapel and we go to these places, but I'd love to see the kids look at how it's transformed, how this Crypt Chapel is transformed into this 1920 movie set.
Right.
And what are all the jobs? And I'm trying to get people as they come here to spend an afternoon
mm-hmm.
with the kids yeah. saying, listen, these are the grips. These are the guys who do this.
Yeah.
And kids who are like 12, 13, they say, man, we never even knew those jobs existed.
Exactly. I always say, like, when people, you always hear a lot of complaints about, you know, the kids in our community, like, oh, they just want to be rappers or ball players. And I'm like, well, you know, first of all, that's not what they're only saying. But for the ones that are saying that, a lot of times it comes from that's what they know as guaranteed success, because they know somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody who became a rapper or became a basketball player. Like, those seem like tangible experiences and or goals because they've seen it done. But if they were to know, like, you can make six figures being a graphic designer.
That's
like,
right.
If they knew those things and were exposed to it, then I think it would be a different story.
Yeah. Our guest is Mimi Valdez. She's the creative director. She wears a lot to have.
Chief creative officer.
Chief, what did I say?
I think, I don't know, creative officer, something.
Well, but here, bottom line.
Bottom line, exactly.
Chief creative officer of I Am Other, which is Pharrell Williams Media Creative Collective. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we wrap up. I want to continue this conversation because I want to talk about power and control. And at the end of the day, it's a cliche, but that's kind of what life is about, is power. I mean, it's about more than that, but mm-hmm. It's about power and control. Who controls what you see? Who controls how it gets there? Who green lights? And how can we as people of color do that? And thing is, and we'll talk about when we come back. I'm going to, have you been following the Colin Kaepernick thing? One sports question.
But you've
been following that about the whole thing.
Yeah.
Because it's about power, control, mm-hmm. image, and other. So we're going to take a quick break and come back with the real story. We're going to come back in just 2 seconds on Bill Roden on Sports and Beyond. Hello, everyone. Welcome, boy. It's dark in Harlem, USA.
It's
now.
Dark, I know.
Maybe when you got here, it was bright.
It was bright.
Now it's dark, but it's okay because this is gentrified Harlem, and you'll be just fine.
Are you driving home?
I'm not.
Oh,
I
you're
wish,
not? Yeah, oh, okay, we'll be, all right, we'll all figure right. out. Anyway.
I would drive you home, but my Ford Mustang convertible is in the shop. In fact, I just visited the shop today in the Bronx. And Marty, what's Marty's name? But Marty is like,
shout out to Marty.
Shout out to Marty, who's going to give me a real good price. But he had the car. I love my Ford Mustang convertible. But he had the engine was out, the transmission was out.
Oh wow!
It was almost like I should say, but my wife had like cesarean, and it's like when you. You just see the parts on the table.
Oh,
you just
wow.
see, like, the, you know, it's a whole different thing.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Okay. But anyway.
That was interesting.
Yeah. My guest is Mimi Valdez. Before we were talking about me seeing the movie crews and how important it is,
mm-hmm.
it's fine to be the actors, but the power and control. And one of my questions, again, I spent 30-something years at the New York Times. 26 of just writing basically opinion about
mm-hmm.
largely about power and control
mm.
and how you get it. And one of the things I'm wondering, and this is kind of having been a jazz critic, then writing in sports for
mm-hmm.
so long, and now kind of things are converging. Where do you think, you know, you look at people like Pharrell, you look at Jay-Z, Beyonce, mm-hmm. who seem, and others I'm probably forgetting, who seem to have a real firm grip on power and control,
right.
how to get it, how to keep it, how to use it. And I'm wondering, Do you think that the artists have, black artists and artists of color, have a firmer grasp and grip on power than what you perceive in sports, where you still have a lot of black guys in the NBA and in football, but no power? I mean, very, very, very little power at all.
Yeah, well, because they're part of, you know, they're quote unquote, you know, owned by these sports teams, right? So you're representing someone, you know, you're representing yourself, but ultimately you're part of a team and you have to kind of, you know, they're leading on what you can and can't do. Whereas music artists, you know, they have all the power. Like, they can decide what they want to do. Obviously, depending on, you know, who they are, they're still answering to a label. But once you get to a certain point, the label is kind of answering to you because you have all the power. When you, you know, when you're Beyonce, you know, her record label's not telling her what to do. She's telling them what to do.
Has that changed? I mean, is it changing? Because there was a time, remember we were talking a couple of weeks ago with Ulis Cathy, who does a lot of jazz stuff. He's and he was talking about back in the day when you had like the labels kind of controlled everything, you know, Atlantic or whatever. But he's saying now because the delivery system of music is changing.
I think that's changing. I mean, you know, I'm not super well versed in sort of all the record industry stuff and that part of sort of Pharrell's, you know, sort of life. But what I can say, just being, you know, from where I sit and obviously my past as a music journalist and just kind of, you know, seeing everything, totally, like everything's Spotify, you know, Tidal, YouTube, obviously when that first came out, like all of that has changed the way we consume music. So of course, you know, there's been a lot of debate about like, what do you need a label for if you can go and make your own deal with iTunes and release your album? I mean, the big debate, I don't know if you guys know, with Frank Ocean, where I don't understand how, but I guess he only had a 2-album deal with Def Jam.
Right.
But what he did was he fulfilled, you know, his obligation. And then with Endless, that second album he did. And then literally, I think, a week later, he released...
with iTunes.
With iTunes. Right. He released
and went around,
Blonde.
And went around the label.
Yeah, because he didn't have a label. But right. I guess there's a question of like, well, you just delivered one, you know, to fulfill your obligation. Isn't there supposed to be some sort of, I don't even know. I'm like speaking off of like just what I read, but I'm like, wow, that's kind of amazing. That's so daring that he was just like, whatever, I'm just going to go ahead and make, not only am I going to make my new deals directly with iTunes, I'm going to release it and kind of cannibalize that other record that I gave to you guys. Like, it's kind of crazy. Like a week ago. It was like a video album. And look, that's amazing too. And I'm sure that it'll do well. But I can imagine as the label, they're probably like, what is going on? And I heard that supposedly they have banned now like artists doing streaming things. But again, I don't know how much they're going to be able to control that.
Who could ban? I mean, how do you enforce? I guess, and this gets back to power control. If you got enough power, you could find a way to crush people.
Totally, right. Of course, you know? Of course. I mean, it just, again, like once you get to a certain point, I just don't know how useful labels can be. Labels definitely, you know, radio and labels definitely go hand in hand. So if you want that kind of success, I think they still have a very good stronghold on the radio industry. But, you know, there's whether it's Lana Del Rey or Tyler the Creator, I mean, there's so many artists who are successful and make a lot of money and don't have any songs on the radio.
But it's also goes back to that daring to be great thing, because the people, I mean, I think they're still the easier way to do it is to sign with a label, basically sign your life away, you know, get some sort of advance. But when, you know, when you're more confident in yourself and you have that dare to be great mentality, it'll lead you, you know, the rewards are probably greater down the line.
Totally. But you got to remember, I mean, a lot of artists, you know, sign the deals because they're like, they think they need the help from the label, or they're like excited about it in advance or whatever it is. But like Chance the Rapper, from the minute we heard him, everybody was trying to sign him. He was like, I'm never signing to one of you guys. I'm going to keep all the control. Thank you very much.
Right.
And that's paying off now.
Yep. Totally paying off. But best thing he ever could
have
did.
Yeah. But you have to have that deep.
You have to have that. And also the means to be able to do that. Right, as well. You have to have the...
It's thunder here in Harlem. It's raining. Cats and dogs.
Yeah, you have to...
Spillage of water.
Yeah, a little spillage of water. But you have to have the, you know, the confidence that you're going to be okay, or you right. have to have, you know, parents that are going to support you, or a spouse or a boyfriend, girlfriend, like family members, like, you know, if you're going to do it, because it may take a minute. It's not so easy to become a successful music artist, right? So
it is hard. That's right. It's hard.
Anything in entertainment is really hard, because it has nothing to do with, you know, math is very reliable. If you're an excellent mathematician, it's all good. Right. Whereas you can be an amazing singer and no one may never know your name.
That's right. So, and that's one thing I didn't ask you about when we were doing your biography, but there is this thing of grinding. We're talking about how are you sitting here yes. next to and for all the stuff you talked about, NYU and all that, at the end of the day,
you got to do the work.
You got to do the work.
You got to do the work. As Bevy Smith, Harlem native, she has a show on Sirius. She's been on and had a show on Bravo. She's, you know, always said that. I get that phrase from her. Do the work. You know, mm-hmm. like all these, you know, young kids, especially coming up nowadays, everyone expects for it to happen overnight. And sure, mm-hmm. there's some people, there are exceptions to every rule, but the people who have longevity, people like myself, that I cannot believe it's been almost 25 years since really? I've been a media executive. That's wow. nuts. But that's because, you know, I do the work. Like it's not about all the fancy glamour. I could care less about all that stuff. It's exciting and it's nice, and you know, that's definitely fun, but ultimately it's about the work and doing good work so that you can have the longevity and you can get these opportunities to continue to, you know, work in all these different mediums and fields. It's because you've established a reputation for yourself. Like the reason why I'm able to have success in Hollywood with these projects, not only, yes, I have a celebrity producing partner, which right. obviously opens doors, but then I'm the one in the meeting, right? So, and it's right, because right. it's my background as a journalist and my success with Vibe and Latina. So I've done something. So that's what helps me in these meetings, where it's like, oh, okay, you come with a pedigree, right, you know, right, so to speak. So
and also the confidence.
Well, and the confidence too, because I'm like, well, you know,
I've done something.
Yeah, yeah, I've done something. Right, I'm not right, just, you know, right. the homie, you know, like I actually have like a track record, and you can speak to people in my old industry who will be like, oh yeah, you know, I was nominated for an ASME in General Excellence under, you know, like, so it's, I have those things that can help, you know, yes, we can get some doors open, but in order to continue the conversations, I have to do the work.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, this is like our one sports question. And that's not a question, but we asked you before. You're following the Colin Kaepernick thing. What's your thing? For those of you, well, Bill wrote on sports, you know about this, but about the brother decided that he wasn't going to sit out the national anthem. What do you think?
I get it. I didn't understand it. I mean, you know, this country has not been kind to people of color. It's a country built on slavery. And, you know, for people, anyone who's screaming, oh, he's not patriotic, it's like, but, you know, do you understand yeah. why he would want to make that choice? I mean, right. I think if we're going to talk about, you know, being a patriot and what it means to live in America and whatever, then you have to, you know, freedom of speech, opinions, like all that is welcome here. And if he feels, whether it was in that moment or whether it's forever in his life, that he does not want to do that, he has that right. That's kind of part of what America is built on, right? Like right. people have the right to express their opinion. He doesn't agree with it. That should be fine.
Right. And I think you hit it on the head when you say you get it, because a lot of people don't get it. And I guess and I guess for the most part, if you're not in somebody's similar situation or shoes, you probably don't get it. Because I see, you know, some white people saying, you know, first that he's being unpatriotic, but also coming out with excuses. Oh, he's just doing it for attention, or he, you know, his career is on the downside.
Yeah,
so
that's
he's
silly.
Doing it for attention, but you don't get it, because yeah. anybody who gets it understands
if you've lived in America as a person of color, you get it. Whether you agree with it or not, whether you're like, oh, well, you know what, I wouldn't cause waves, I would do that. Right. Whatever it is, whatever right. your way of, you know, making a statement about the unfair treatment of people of color in this country is. Like, everyone has the right to, everyone has their levels of comfortability of how they want to express those things. That man chose that moment to do it. And he has that right, because again, if you have not lived in this country as a person of color, then I guess you don't know. But I would hope, just like my friends who aren't people of color, they get it, because right. they are sympathetic and are very clear about what this that this country has not always been fair to people of color. So, you know, I would be very disappointed in any of my friends that you know, white friends that were like, well, that's crazy. I'd be like, what are you, what?
Right. How'd you get to be my friend?
Yeah, like, I'd be like, wait, whoa, let's reevaluate this. Because, again, everybody in my circle is like, yeah, we get it. And it's not a big deal, you know, and the people making it a big deal. So, like, I just feel like that's, you know, freedom of speech in this country, freedom of opinions, freedom of, like, let that man do what he wanted to do. He didn't kill anybody. He didn't, like, nothing happened. Like,
right.
It's just an opinion. That's all it right. is. He has the right to do that.
Exactly. He didn't kill any unarmed,
yeah, exactly.
innocent people.
You know, that's unpatriotic. How about that?
That's unpatriotic. But also, you know, the interesting thing, too, about your industry and this whole sports thing, for example, when you've got the Academy Awards and those kind of things, they don't play the national anthem. In other words, they don't start and play the national anthem and make right. everybody. Where in sports, it's been this crazy tradition where the game starts, and you know, we've all sat through it, and you politicize it by the very beginning by playing the national anthem. But it is interesting, though, in your field, where people have taken the opportunity of when they accept awards to make speeches, and that is a big deal. I mean, mm-hmm. in other words,
oh, yeah.
you pick your spots, you know, and you know, is it your right, your responsibility to basically protest? And everybody, there are very few people who do it, whether it's in your industry, in sports industry, not everybody does. I mean, in fact, most people don't. Most people toe the line.
Of course, because it's easier to just toe the line and, you know, just live, just coast and be like, you know, I'm not trying to get involved. But I encourage anyone, when you feel something like that and you feel a need to, like, comment on whatever it is, I don't hold anyone accountable to, I think everyone, do whatever you want, do whatever is comfortable. I would hope that people, you know, especially people of color that are successful, you do your part, you give back. Like, I hope that people do that. But at the end of the day, as Americans, we right. have the right to do whatever it is that we feel like it. Right. And especially when it comes to opinion, you can't tell that man to do something he doesn't want to do. So what?
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, and well, yeah. So boom. Hey, listen, our guest for the last hour, wow, has been Mimi Valdez. You're a proud Puerto Rican.
Puerto Rican and Cuban.
And Cuban too.
Mm-hmm. Puerto Rican and Cuban.
That.
Yeah, yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
Where's
yeah, father, my dad's family's from Cuba, and mom's family's from, my father passed when my mom was pregnant with me, so I grew up mostly with my mom's family, but I know my, you know, I'm close with my aunt from my dad's side. Mm-hmm. I've been 3 times.
Wow.
Yeah.
What do you think about the normalization of...
I'm interested to see how it all kind of plays out, you know? Like, I'm watching it very sort of like, okay, let's see what this does. Right. But, I mean, it's such a beautiful country, and the people there are just amazing, and yeah, I would just, you know, we'll see.
I just hope it doesn't become like Las Vegas.
I know. That would be...
which is almost, you almost have to say, like, we talk about gentrification.
Yeah.
That's the American way. And you're like,
listen,
oh my God, here we go.
You know, yeah. I mean, look, I think Barbados, when I went to Barbados, they told me that they put a McDonald's there and it failed. And I thought that was like the funniest thing in the world, that I was like, wow, like, because the island is just like, no, we don't want that. Like, right. you know, we have our own, we have Chefette, I think, is there, fast food restaurant. So I hope that it kind of ends up being that sort of vibe where they, right. you know, keep their culture, keep what it is that they are, and not become like, you know, all of that.
We hope so.
Yeah.
Mimi Valdez. Thank you very much. Mimi, is that?
No, it's a nickname. My real name is Michelle, but no one calls me Michelle. Okay. Not even my mom.
Not even on the show.
Yeah. Did your mom start that?
No. Funny story. I have a cousin also named Michelle. I was supposed to be named, since my father had died when my mom was pregnant, his name was Miguel. my father's family got to the got to the hospital first, so they convinced my mom to name me after my dad. And then when my grandmother got there, she was like, "What? I'm never calling her Michelle. I'm calling her Mimi." And then that was it.
Okay,
that's
okay.
Right. You have brothers, sisters?
No, just me. Only child.
Only child.
Yeah, okay. Only child.
Raisa, my daughter. Did you hear that? Only child. See, child. It works. Hey, Mimi, thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you so much. Such an honor to be on the show with you guys and with you, of course. Obviously, you know, as a fellow journalists, I'm in awe of your career, and thank you for having me.
Oh, no, the pleasure is ours. El gusto es mio. Mimi Valdez is creative officer, chief creative officer of I Am Other. And listen, the big thing is in January of 2017, you know, you got to support, you got to start talking it up, the upcoming movie called Hidden Figures, a phenomenal, phenomenal movie of untold an untold story of three black women who kind of made it happen. So
they sure did.
Yeah, a lot of love, a lot of respect, great accomplishment.
Thank you.
Really great, man.
Thank you.
This is really, really tremendous. Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. You gotta come back, as they say, tomorrow. Hey, thank you so
cool,
much.
Thank you.
All right, everybody, we'll be back. God bless. We'll see you on the other side in Harlem, USA. Bill Roden on sports.
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.